interest, rightly so, in what these files show, if anything, about how Epstein's sex trafficking operation ensnared some of these kind of bold-faced names. The truth is, and I'm not trying to be coy or evade the question, we just really have no idea what is in these files and what is going to actually be released in a way that is legible. And I think there's an expectation or a concern that these might be very, very heavily redacted if they get released at all. And hopefully I'm wrong about that, because I think the whole world is clamoring for some transparency here. And I, just as someone who's been covering this for like six plus years now, with my colleagues at the Times, we are really eager to see what's in these files.
And finally, what surprised you most as you investigated him for all of these years? We just have 30 seconds.
I think what surprised me the most was just how pedestrian some of his scams were. This is not someone who is hatching this like extremely elaborate plot to con sophisticated people through this, all these like bells and whistles. He was just grabbing people's money and running with it. And for all of the attention that's been paid to the possibility of Epstein being part of spy services or running this really sophisticated blackmail operation, the truth that we found, and there may be more to it, but what we found was much more run-of-the-mill and kind of low-level than that.
David Enrich, we want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Investigations Editor for The New York Times. We'll link to your new investigation, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, The Untold Story of How Jeffrey Epstein Got Rich. Happy birthday to Jeff Stauch, and happy belated birthday to Renee Feltz. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The majority of Americans just couldn't go with the centrist. So they went with somebody really strong, even though he's a little bit crazy. Voters got us into this mess. Now it seems voters are starting to get us out of this mess. New types of Democrats are leading the way. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
For decades, I've been saying that if people know what Republicans stand for, but Democrats have no clear identity, we lose. We gotta hoist something up the flagpole to see if people salute. For far too long, Democrats have convinced themselves there's something known as centrism, and that it's best to, that's the best way to elect Democrats. But as Texas former Agriculture Commissioner Jim Hightower put it, there are two things in the middle of the road: yellow stripes and dead armadillos, neither of which are likely to earn a lot of votes. You got to stand for something. Some of us have been fighting for Democratic wins since, well, forever, really. And again, we've got to give people a reason to vote Democrat. We can't just be not Trump. Hillary and Kamala Harris tried that. The most recent string of special elections shows that when we do stand for something, guess what? We Democrats win. Here in New Hampshire, a centrist incumbent House member is running for an open U.S. Senate seat. He's who the so-called smart money is on. Polls show him way ahead, as of the moment with the primary election nearly a year away, that is. But wait, there's an upstart running for the Democratic nomination who seems to be picking up steam. Karishma Manzoor is a PhD scientist, peace advocate, and nonprofit leader who spent more than two decades working in medical research. Imagine medical research, what a concept. After witnessing families struggling to meet basic needs, she turned her focus to a deeper problem. Too many in Washington prioritize wealthy interests over the well-being of ordinary people. Well, you may not have heard of her, especially if you're not living in New Hampshire. Karishma Manzoor is her name, and the first name sounds sort of like charisma, which is not a bad thing. My first question is, Teddy Kennedy couldn't answer the question and in 1980 and thus lost the election. Karishma, why are you running? What's your background? Why are you running?
First of all, Bert, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm honored. And I just want to say hello to everyone that's listening. So there are several reasons why I'm, let me briefly introduce myself. So thank you very much for saying, yes, I'm a scientist. Yes, I did work for over 20 years in medical research, mostly in neurological diseases. And I focused mostly on epilepsy and depression. And I loved my job. I absolutely love my job. I have been a lifelong Democrat, but I was also focused more on my career, my family. I was happy when an election season was coming along. Here in New Hampshire, we're all political junkies.
Yes. So
it's very exciting, especially given our status as first in the nation primary. Everyone just moves through our state, and even in my small town of Exeter, I don't have to go far to see all the slate of presidential candidates go through my town. So being in being a Granite Stater, it's just always, politics is always on your mind. And I've campaigned for Democrats. I've been excited when Democrats won. And that was well and good. But several years ago, I started to become disheartened because here I was working on these life-saving treatments, but I realized many of these treatments will never be accessible to millions of Americans because either they are not insured or because of underinsurance. So Bert, as you know, we live in the richest country in the world. So why do we have this severe healthcare problem? So that allowed me to start to move a little bit away from my regular job and going into the nonprofit sector to understand what is the root cause of this issue. And lo and behold, it's not because we don't have a solution to providing universal health coverage for all Americans. It's not that we lack resources. It's because of big money in politics is stopping us from enacting a wonderful piece of legislation such as Medicare for All.
Right.
So I became a lot more involved in the nonprofit sector to basically think about pieces of legislation, whether it was resolutions or bills that were coming on the Senate floor or the House floor, and if they were of importance to me or my community, I started to advocate for them through this, my nonprofit work. And I am on the board of an organization called Open Democracy. This mm-hmm. is an organization that was started by Granny D. Haddock. And Granny D. is a native to New Hampshire. And she always explained to us that the greatest threat to our democracy is big money in politics. And at age 89, she walked all the way from California to Washington, D.C. to raise awareness of the influence of big money on our Congress members and lawmakers. And this was even before the passage of Citizens United. So imagine now the floodgates have opened up. So for several years, I was working in the nonprofit sector. And I promise I am going to answer your question, but you have to understand who I am before to
yes.
understand why
that's
I'm
the idea.
Running.
Yes.
That's, yes.
That's what we want.
So for several years, it started about 2021 that I became very involved, because who has the time to follow bills and resolutions? I mean, we have jobs, we have families, we might have family members who are ill or need extra attention. So it is a lot of work to follow along with these bills and resolutions that are being introduced in Congress. So around 2021, I became very involved because something else that's very close to my heart is the fact that many Americans are suffering from wages that are stagnant and very low. So as you know, and many of your listeners know, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour.
Unbelievable.
And it has been stuck at $7.25 since 2009. So it is terrible. And in a state like New Hampshire, our state minimum wage is stuck at the federal minimum wage. We're about one of 22 states that has the same state level wage as the federal minimum wage. And all around us in New England, all the other New England states have $15, $16 an hour. We're still stuck at $7.25. Mm. So I was very happy that in 2021, President Biden tried to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 an hour. And for someone who is extremely, I'm trying to work a lot with folks who are struggling, this was very important for me.
And so you ran for the House at that point, is that correct?
No, I did not. No, this is my first candidacy, but there's a story to it. So it did not pass the Senate. So this bill to increase the minimum wage did not pass in the Senate. But our two senators who are Democrats and who I've supported, both of them voted against increasing the minimum wage.
Wow.
This was back in 2021.
Oh my, I forgot that.
Yes. So, Bert, that broke my heart. Here I am, a lifelong Democrat, excited about such an important piece of legislation. And even, what is the meaning of campaigning for folks who don't consider, who will not support a starvation wage to be moved to a less of a starvation wage? I mean, even if it went to 15, it would still not be enough, but it would be much better than 725. Anyway, so then that's when I started to say, okay, maybe it's not enough to vote for any Democrat. We should vote for the right Democrat. So I became a lot more involved in the nonprofit sector. I ended up joining two other organizations, New Hampshire Ranked Choice Voting. I'm on the board of that, and New Hampshire Peace Action, and I used to be on the board of that. So those are my three nonprofit organizations kind of give you an idea about who I am. Peace Action, because I'm a peace advocate. Ranked Choice Voting, because I believe in democracy. And Open Democracy, because my God, it is such a great threat to our democracy, the big money influence.
Oh, yes.
So then from 2021 till now, till before I launched, I didn't challenge the system. I stayed within the system. I did not say, okay, let's scrap it. Let's vote for somebody else. I said, okay, these are my two senators and these are my two representatives. I'm going to stay within the system and start to advocate for pieces of the legislation that are important to me. So for example, when we were looked at why would the senators vote against increasing the minimum wage. What our research showed was Senator Maggie Hassan receives money from an organization called National Restaurant Association. So that's like a special interest group. And they are very much against increasing the minimum wage.
Sure.
And that was, of course, tied into the fact that I was working with the Open Democracy and we're always fighting against big money. So that is an example of big money. And National Restaurant Association, what we call them is the other NRA. So, just wanted to throw that in. So then for several years, I was trying to work through the nonprofit sector and understand more about issues that are important to me and how to advocate for it. Then in October 2023, after the attack by Hamas on Israel, it reached a fever pitch from a peace activist perspective. So anyone who has followed the career of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, who has been on again, off again in power for the last 30 years, knew that once that attack happened on October 7th, that this Benjamin Netanyahu was going to be out for blood. He had always been hinting at basically annihilation of the Palestinian people. And this was from a peace activist perspective and some people who are very involved with understanding foreign policy and especially looking at people like Benjamin Netanyahu, we understood that this is a call to action for us. Over the course of several months, we quickly formed a coalition. We call ourselves New Hampshire Coalition for Just Peace in the Middle East. It includes at the moment about 15 different organizations, Palestine Education Network, Jewish Voice for Peace, Not in My Name, which is another Jewish group, American Friends Service Committee, Peace Action, of course, et cetera. And so we quickly formed because in a state like New Hampshire, we realized that our two senators and our two representatives who are heavily funded by AIPAC may not side with peace the way we would like them to respond. So in the process, we advocated, we went to the senator's offices and the representative's offices, we wrote letters to the editors, we wrote op-eds, we made phone calls, we put together petitions, had people on the ground sign it. All we were asking for was, please don't send weapons of mass destruction, basically, to Israel to commit war crimes, that we should not be complicit in war crimes being committed by Benjamin Netanyahu and his ultra-right wing government.
Yes.
So again, I did not challenge the system. I was still working within the system as a private citizen trying to advocate for peace through my federal delegates. But it was to no avail. The voice of the big money is much louder than the voices of the constituents. And you see this across the country in many different respects. So, yes, Sandra Shaheen did vote twice to supporting Senator Sanders' joint resolutions of disapproval to stop weapons, specific weapons transfers to Israel. So we were very happy with that. But the other three federal delegates did not change their minds.
Right.
And we tried very hard. I know that I'm not getting there yet, because you have to understand, it was not like I woke up one day and be like, oh, I want to run for the Senate. No, right. it was years in the making.
It's a big deal, yeah.
It's a big deal. Then on top of it, so you're still working within the system. In a group of my peace advocates, my peace activist friends, also were repeatedly going to Representative Chris Pappas's office, asking for a meeting with the representative or a phone call. And they went 12 times from January 2024 to May 2024. They would go every other week, because in between they would go to the other offices. So we were kind of taking, targeting different offices over the course of several months. And again, showing up with articles. Sometimes, you know, we gave them the benefit of the doubt. We said, maybe they don't know. Maybe we have to teach them. Or we have to inform them. So we would take, you know, reports from the United Nations, reports from Bet Salam, which is a humanitarian foundation based in Israel. We would take reports from Oxfam or Amnesty International. Like, maybe we have to inform them about what's going on in the ground. So, from January 2024 to May 2024, a group of my friends, peace activists, I should just say, went 12 times to Representative Pappas' office.
Right.
And all they were asking for, again, was a meeting or a phone call. On the 12th time, they were basically getting a runaround. Oh, he's busy, or we'll call you back, and none of this really was happening. And mind you, we have a tiny state. We only have two
members district, of Congress, right?
Two House districts. So these were people from the district, and they were also community leaders who were representing their people. And on the 12th time, they decided to do a peace sit-in. That's something peace activists do, or it's a form of civil debate. And you saw this during the civil rights movement. A lot of, like, you challenge the system. You say, I'm going to sit at this counter, even though I'm not the right complexion. Or I'm not going to, like Rosa Parks, you did not get a move to the back of the bus. These are all basically acts of civil disobedience.
Yes.
So anyway, so they went in. It was a Friday. It was 5:00. The gentleman, one of the office people, comes out and says, you know, it was my day off. I got a call from Representative Pappas telling me you have to leave, otherwise the landlord's going to call the police. And they said, we will leave, but just give us a meeting or a phone call. That's all we're requesting. They refused, and the police showed up. I don't know if so most probably this gentleman turned around and called the police. All five of them were arrested. Now, let me explain how dangerous these people were that the representative was trying to avoid.
Oh, I can just imagine.
Yes, exactly. Two of them were 80-year-old women, and one was in a wheelchair. That's Janet Simon and Janet Zeller. One was Reverend David Grisha Jones. He's the leader of the Community Church of Durham. One was Amy Antonucci from Peace Action. She's a tiny lady. She's also a goat farmer. And the fifth person was M. Friedrichs, who is a town councilor from Durham. And M at the time was 8 months pregnant or 7 months pregnant. I mean, this was like the dangerous five.
Yeah, really.
The wild five that nobody would, no representative then wants to meet. So, Bert, what is public service all about? Is it to serve the public, or is it to serve special interests?
Uh-huh. What a question. Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Live. Our guest today is running for U.S. Senate, and she has risen from the movement. And a friend of mine, who's also a terrific author, pointed out in his book, What It Took to Win, how Democrats win when there's a movement beneath it. And our guest, Karishma Mansour, is definitely rising from the movement. And we're asking, why is she running? Ted Kennedy couldn't answer that question, and he kind of lost. And it seems pretty clear why Karishma Manzoor is running for U.S. Senate. And you've had a bunch of listening sessions. Tell us about that. What are the listening sessions, moving beyond, you know, just the audience of the peace movement?
Yes. So, but quickly, just because if people say, wait, she stopped at May 2024. But basically, right. Public service to me means you serve the public. This is it. You meet with your constituents. You may agree with them. You may not agree with them. But you owe them a meeting, especially if they're asking 12 times in the middle of right. a genocide. And they are representing also their own community or own organization. So this is what I do want to say. So I saw in the two senators and our two representatives that they have become they are no longer serving the public. They are not right. acting like public right. servants. Right. And you see this across the country. So anyway, so I know there's a second question, but I hope people understand my heart was breaking from the suffering in the United States from unlivable wages, or what I call starvation wages,
yes.
from the fact that we don't have a universal health care, which I touched on like 20 minutes ago, and which, Bert, just to finish that one topic, over 50,000 Americans die each year. 50,000 Americans die each year because of this insurance problem. Imagine how heartbreaking that is. And then, so starvation wages, the housing crisis is severe in New Hampshire, healthcare crisis is severe. A childcare crisis is another huge problem, so I did not see either the Republicans or an independent or a Democrat rising up to the occasion. And I'm coming from the people. So I am the face of the campaign, but then behind me are several hundred people who were done. They were like, this current system, we cannot just keep recycling the same problems over and over again. The crisis, right. we are in this crisis, not by accident. We are here because our lawmakers have specifically decided like which law legislation to sponsor or pass. And so this system is by design. So I wanted to say that. Anyway, so I'm running. So what was the second question? I forgot. You just asked.
Well, I was asking what are these listening sessions? But I think what's coming out of what you're saying is that members of Congress have thus far all too often lost their sense of what they're doing and what they're yeah. about and what public mm-hmm. service is. And that inspired you to run out of rising from a movement. Mm-hmm. And so you're going around the state and you've mm-hmm. had experience, talking to people one-on-one.
Yes.
So what are these listening sessions all about? And are you hearing from people in these listening sessions that there's a hunger for more centrist candidates, more middle of the road?
Okay. So here in New England, it's part of our tradition. Town halls, like that's where you meet one-on-one with your representatives, your elected officials. And it's a wonderful part of our culture, right? We get to see them, we get to hear about what is going on in the Senate or the House, and you get to ask questions. But they're missing in action. Most of them are, right. Most of our elected officials, and I'm not talking about the state level, I'm talking about at the federal level. And I don't know if Kelly Ayotte is even doing it, she's our governor. But we always see them in photo ops, like all these pictures, like really curated pictures of them shaking someone's hand or laughing with some constituent, but you don't have access to them anymore. They are not addressing your concerns. They definitely don't want to be available to answer questions or listen to the concerns of the citizens. I am coming from the people. This is something we need. I am not running, this is not a vanity project, this is a project coming arising from the pain and suffering. So of course I'm going to listen to the people. Sometimes I have the answer, sometimes I don't, but I ask folks to help me understand what is keeping them awake at night. So housing crisis is an ongoing issue here in New Hampshire. We are already 24,000 units short, and if we don't address it by 2040, we're going to be 90,000 units short. And one of the problems here is private equity is coming in and purchasing a lot of the rental apartments or the manufactured home neighborhoods. So this is a severe problem in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I am hearing about is the healthcare crisis. So our state is already, the revenue is so low that we cannot even support our citizens because there are so many federal cuts to some programs, and we don't have the money to even offset it at the state level. Some of our neighboring states are trying to help their citizens, but either Kelly Ayotte is not interested, which I wouldn't be surprised, yeah, or it's because there is no money. So these are so the healthcare crisis, the housing crisis,
right.
The ICE raids is actually on people's minds as well.
Uh-huh.
It hasn't been as violent as, say, Los Angeles or Portland, etc. But we have had incidences of ICE arresting people here.
Yes.
And several of our sheriff offices have decided to work with ICE.
Right.
So this is, of course, another concern because, of course, I mean, anyone who is breaking the law, there should be a evidence against them. There should be a signed legal warrant for their arrest, and they should be detained. But they should also have their due process.
Due process, yes,
exactly. But many of these folks are just being picked up off the street. Right. Sometimes ICE is just standing in front of, like, Lowe's or Home Depot, or going to these areas where there's a construction going on or landscaping work is going on. I mean, this is targeting people because of the color of their skin. And so this is, yes, another concern for people. And of course, the war in Gaza. The war in Gaza, from foreign policy perspective, the war in Gaza is on a lot of people's minds. I mean, it's very interesting how many people are aware of it, how many people are traumatized by it. I mean, those images of human beings getting bombed or killed or starving or trying to survive in flooded tents, if it's causing people heartache, if it's making people very sad, that is normal. Human beings we've evolved to care for each other. When we see another human being suffering and we have these physical reactions to it and severe mental reactions, we lose sleep, we feel upset, that is normal.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is why so many people, so many lawmakers don't have that same reaction. How can they sit there day after day, year after year, because now we're going into now beyond, it's, what is it now, two and a half years almost now, and they still find ways to excuse their behavior or to excuse,
right,
war crimes. And so that is also something I'm hearing. Sometimes some folks do talk about Ukraine, but Venezuela is also on people's mind.
Uh-huh, right, I bet.
Yes. So I would say those are the things that I'm hearing about.
Well, I think it's curious. I've always been surprised by this, how people generally aren't motivated by foreign policy when they come to vote. Do you think this has changed?
I can't answer for that. That's going to be, you'll have to talk to someone who gets paid to analyze it. For my purpose, again, I am coming from the people, and so I need to hear what the people are asking for and then address and respond to the needs of the people. So yeah, I haven't done a survey about what they'll do.
Right. Well, I hope people do, because foreign, mm-hmm, policy is just so important. It's wrecking the, mm-hmm, reputation of America in the world.
Can I touch on that just a little bit? I wasn't sure if you were going to ask me. Okay, so I think that is a very important point. So let me talk a little bit about why people should care about what's going on in Gaza. So from a moral perspective, it's reprehensible what is going on, right? At the moment, if Benjamin Netanyahu, Bezalel Smotrich, and Ben-Gavir, these are the high-ranking officials in the ultra-right-wing government of Israel right now, they have made it very clear that they want to annihilate all 70 million Palestinians, whether they're pushed out into the border states, or if they are flown out to South Africa. Have you heard of those flights now?
Yeah,
random flights to South Africa, or basically being killed or starved to death, that those people have to go. The land that is currently Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem and other enclaves, basically Israel wants it to be part of the country of Israel. So people should care. I think every human being should care about the suffering of another human being. But say, all right, even if you don't, even if that doesn't move you, let's look at the fiscal perspective. As an American taxpayer, we're spending some over $30 billion we spent in 2024 sending weapons to Israel. Over $30 billion. That's a huge amount of money. People should care about that. I mean, that's your tax dollars. Yeah. To put it into perspective, the annual budget of a state like New Hampshire is $8 billion. And we are having so many cuts to really important social programs. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What if we had another $1 billion? What if we had $2 billion? Imagine, Bert, what we could do in New Hampshire. But what if the state of people of New Hampshire asked the federal government, hey, can we have another extra billion or two? Because there's such severe cuts to our public education, to there's infrastructure that is not getting fixed. There are important programs that are getting cut. People are going hungry. Our senior citizens are suffering. The federal government's not going to care. Yet when Benjamin Netanyahu asks for another several billion dollars of weapons, we suddenly have that money. And I'm going to touch on that in a second. So even if people, like I said, don't care about, say, from the moral perspective, I hope they'll care from the fiscal perspective. But even if they don't care from the moral or fiscal perspective, I hope they'll care from a legal perspective. Because our foreign policy, the Leahy Law is very clear. Any, the United States government cannot send weapons to any foreign entity that is violating human rights. It's a clear law.
Wow.
So our Congress members, by sending weapons to Israel in the middle of a genocide, is violating human rights. Is violating federal laws. You and I, Bert, and many of your listeners can't even run a red light without getting in trouble with the law. And here are our elected officials violating federal laws. So from a legal perspective, it's also a really bad position. But even if you don't care about the legal perspective, the moral perspective, or the fiscal perspective, what we have to understand is the system that is benefiting from the war in Gaza is the same system or the same forces that are keeping our people at starvation wages, keeping universal health care is not allowing universal health care plans to pass. Because our lawmakers, when I say big money in politics, sometimes we think, oh, okay, so there's like a suitcase full of cash being handed over to some candidates or some lawmakers, and they're being asked to vote in a certain way. So that's like an external big money influence over our lawmakers.
Wow.
But our lawmakers are part of that big money. And what do I mean by that?
Oh.
First of all, our lawmakers in Congress are supposed to make about $175,000, $180,000, but they're all multimillionaires. How is that possible? Because they trade in stocks in companies that they regulate. It's called insider trading. In any private institution, this would be criminal behavior. But in the United States Congress, it is acceptable. So they know which industry is going to benefit from, say, a bill, and they are able to then buy or sell stocks. They become multimillionaires, our Congress members, from stock trading. That's unethical. So when the weapons transfers are taking place, when over $30 billion is going to Israel, the money is basically going to the handful of defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon RTX, etc. Our members of Congress own stocks in those companies. So when they are approving billions of dollars of weapons transfers to Ukraine or to Israel, the stock prices of those companies are going up. And these folks in Congress are basically knowing when to sell and when to buy.
No, outrageous.
Think how it's outrageous. So I looked up the top 20 investors. From Congress, yes. So of the top 20 that are investing in the defense contractors, who are they? All the top 20, 9 were Democrats, 11 were Republicans. And a couple of names you'll recognize. Of the Democrats, it was Nancy Pelosi was one of them. And on the side of the Republicans, one of them was Senator Tuberville. So imagine, my friend, if I wish, I hope that the American people will understand that not only is our money being taken away from our schools, our towns, our state, but it's being used to benefit our lawmakers. And we need to stop this. We absolutely need to stop this. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. You should care.
And I think people do care. People want the government to work on their behalf. They're saying that, and the orange one, President Trump, has said he's for the people, but he's clearly not doing that. It's all for himself. We're talking, if you just tuned in, with Karishma Mazur, who is running for U.S. Senate from New Hampshire. And even if you're not from New Hampshire, you may care about this, because this is a phenomenon that's going on across the country. People to the left, I would say, of the centrist, wimpy Democratic Party are making gains all over the place. Karishma, what do you make of the win of Zoran Mandami in New York City? What can we learn from his successful campaign?
Yeah, so that was amazing. So Zoran Mandami had so many forces against him. That was very interesting. So they were the Democratic establishment was not supporting him. They supported his opponent and Andrew Cuomo. Yeah. But then interestingly, after Andrew Cuomo did not win the primary, he decided to run as an independent. And then the Democratic establishment continued to support Andrew Cuomo as an independent. Isn't the Democratic establishment supposed to support the Democratic winner? And so it was kind of interesting to see the alliance, how the alliances are formed. And it was rather interesting. So Zoran Mamdani did an amazing job where he stayed true to the people. He came from the people. He rose from the pain and suffering of the people, and he stayed true to them, regardless of all the attacks on him. He did not answer to the donor class, and he did not answer to the consultants. So in 2024, just to give you an idea, so to answer it, yes, amazing. Zoran Mamdani ran an amazing campaign. He's a charismatic candidate, and I wish him all the luck. I hope he does really well as a mayor in addressing the needs of his constituents. In 2024, just to sort of build up on this, as a constituent and as a person, it was so frustrating to see how Kamala Harris and her campaign, and of course Biden, they were not addressing the needs of the people. They were not listening to the people. They were, I don't know where they were getting their ideas from, consultants maybe? Because the people were repeatedly telling the Democrats, talk about bread and butter issues and talk about the war in Gaza. So do you remember there was a group, they were called Laborers for Ceasefire? I believe that's what they were called, Labor for Ceasefire.
I don't remember, but I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. So it was United Auto Workers, the Postal Workers Union, large unions formed, I want to say about February 2024, and started to, they wrote a letter saying, we need ceasefire now in Gaza. We cannot keep killing people. We cannot be complicit in war crimes. And over the course of several months, additional unions started to add their names to this letter, calling on the Biden administration to stop the war in Gaza and to stop transferring weapons. Because if Netanyahu does not want to listen to us and he wants to commit war crimes, at least let us not support him. If we cannot stop him, at least let us not support him. And by the time the November elections were coming around, the number of unions that were signed on to that Labor for Ceasefire, and I apologize, it's a website, you can check it. I believe it's Labor for Ceasefire, something like that. Those unions that had signed on to the letter represented over 20 million labor union members, 20 million people. And yet the Biden administration was still not answering to the people. So this is what was so frustrating in 2024. And in terms of Mamdani's campaign, you see that he was listening to his people. What were they asking for? Even if it sounded like, even if the donor class or even if the consultants were criticizing him, he was listening to the people. And that's what public service should be about. What do your constituents need and how can you serve them?
What about people feel isolated these days? You know, people are just sitting, looking at their screens and unconnected to community. But community is really important, especially in a democracy. What do you think can be done to help people feel? Can Congress do anything to help build a sense of community? Is universal child care part of that solution, perhaps?
Oh, wow, what a question.
I've always thought that we have little kids in need of care. We have a lot of older people who like little kids. Let's connect the two, you know, and have Congress, you know, have universal child care and also elder care at the same time, perhaps. I'm not running for office, though.
So I can just tell you from my perspective as a living in my small town of Exeter. So I see a lot of folks, you know, as they're getting older, they're living alone, they need support.
Right.
And they don't have it.
Right.
And before, how did people know that my neighbor is ill, my neighbor had a surgery, my neighbor's about to have a baby? It was because there were a lot of times running into each other on the streets or seeing each other in church or other types of faith-based organizations. And we have lost touch. And that kind of community is sometimes not there anymore for a lot of people. So you do see people in need. And I wish we had multi-generational living going on. Because imagine if a... whether it's a blood relative who can be the elderly person or a friend who is elderly. I mean, imagine the love that they can provide and the wisdom they can provide to children as the middle generation goes to work. So then the older generation can be absolutely there to support the young kids as well as the middle generation. And that sort of a family structure or a community structure, it's so important, right? And you do see that it's been lost in many places. What can a government do? My God, aren't we against big government? Aren't we against it? I mean, community centers are so important, right? So even if you don't want to be supporting faith-based organizations, you can support nonpartisan, secular community centers.
Sure.
And that's, where would that be? So that would be the federal government providing some of the money instead of wasting it on weapons and killing people and sending it back to the communities. Because, my God, we pay enough in taxes. The problem is the taxes are not coming back. The tax funds are not coming back to support our communities. Wouldn't that be nice if we had, like, very active, like a YMCA or where these, there are maybe the bingo room and the gym or the daycare center or a basketball court, something where kids of people of different generations are coming in and mingling and getting to know each other. It would be wonderful. But it's not going to happen, my friend, as long as we spend so much money on frivolous, what I would consider a waste, fraud, and abuse. So, and I can tell you two things that really bother me, and I'm sure that, you know, everyone has their pet peeves. One is, of course, the fact that we spend $900 billion on our Department of Defense budget, right? $900 billion. Again, to put that into perspective, New Hampshire's annual budget is right now, because it's been cut, is $8 billion. And here we are spending $900 billion. And again, that's because of war profiteering and people in Congress benefiting from it. Another, what is our second biggest expenditure, Bert? Let me see.
You tell me.
It's the interest that we pay on our $38 trillion national debt. My friend, it's robbing us. Those two expenditures are robbing our communities of much needed state and federal funding. This is why our public education is so underfunded at the state level and the federal level. And what happens, the poor folks on the ground who are already paying so much in taxes, then they are further burdened by high property taxes.
That's one problem we have in New Hampshire for sure.
Yes. And the $38 trillion, there's no end in sight of the growth. And if as long as that national debt keeps growing, our interest on the national debt keeps growing, and we will have to keep paying. And I can tell you why the national debt is growing if you want.
Sure.
I want listeners to understand. One is all the wars. So the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war added a lot of debt. Sure. It was on a credit card, right? The other is the severe tax cuts that we're giving to the already extremely wealthy people. So not only is there a huge wealth inequality in our current system, where people who are making so little and so struggling so much and paying such high taxes and still not seeing the benefits of their taxes, then in addition to that, the system is already so severely skewed towards the wealthy. But on top of it, again, in the big beautiful bill, there was an additional tax cuts giving more money. And that is going to be a revenue shortfall for the government. And so then, of course, that's going to, it's adding to the national debt, which is further siphoning money away from taxpayers into paying the interest on that national debt instead of the money coming back to our community. So we have to stop this. We have to stop the wars. If it's a national security issue, that's okay. But it is not a national security issue. These are driven by war profiteering. These are driven by maybe someone looking for cheap oil, ExxonMobil. I'm thinking about you right now, whether that was the second Iraq war or what's going on in Venezuela. Sure looks like it might be an oil-related war. What do you think, Bert?
Yeah, a little bit. My goodness. There's a lot of oil there. And how dare they keep their own oil. It's just, there's so much possibility. There's so much good we can do, but we're
there's
not
so
doing
much
because
good we can do.
Because we're wasting our money. Let's face it.
We're wasting our money, yes. And if people say, well, I pay so much in taxes, I agree. We pay so much in taxes, and it doesn't come back to us. And when I say we, I mean the ordinary people. I mean the folks making, not the billionaires. Or the multi-mega millionaires. I'm talking folks, the ordinary folks, whether you're in construction, police, firefighting, nurses, doctors, engineers, regular working
teachers, families. Yeah. And people have criticized the left over the years saying, oh, they're for a class war. Well, let's face it, there is a class war. The very, very rich, the top 0.1% is looting America. they're taxing everybody else. Should there be, as many are starting to suggest, a wealth tax on the amount of wealth that people have aside from their income, which there are, of course, very various ways of shielding that. But should there be a wealth tax? What do you think?
So in New Hampshire, you'd never want to say the T word.
Right.
But let me say it this way. The wealthy should pay their fair share in making sure that our society is running and supporting things that are of importance to us, to all of us. And Reagan started this, didn't he? He's told
us. Yes, Reagan did. You're right.
Give tax breaks to the rich, it's going to trickle down. My friend, it never trickled down.
Never trickles down.
It never down. Did. No, it never trickles down.
We know what trickles down.
Yes. And now what I see is so much misunderstanding among the ordinary folks. So, for example, these Starbucks workers are striking at the moment. and they're asking for livable wages. They're asking for dignity at work. They have changes in their shift without ample notice. They want to work, have a full-time job, but after 20 hours, it becomes, there are certain benefits kick in. So instead of offering additional hours to their workers, what they do, Starbucks does, is they actually hire new people. So everyone stays under 20 hours. This is cruelty, basically. But then I noticed that a lot of folks felt that if Starbucks workers get a raise, their coffee prices are going to go up. Therefore, right. They felt they have to fight against the Starbucks workers getting a raise. So now we are pitting ourselves against our neighbors. They're making us think it's the other, my neighbor, that's the problem. And we're not looking at the billionaires as the problem, or Wall Street as the problem, or the shareholders as the problem. So here is a CEO of Starbucks, and what did he make, like $96 million last year? He made 6,666 times what an average Starbucks worker makes.
Oh, my goodness.
That is the problem. And he's just one of the executives of Starbucks. The shareholders are making so much money, and none of this is being shared with the workers. Then on top of it, you know, let's all treat each other with respect. A Starbucks worker also has family that they have to care for. They have children that they need to care for. When the schedule shifts so much, they don't know where will they, you know, is it a morning schedule? Okay, then they may have someone to take care of their child. Suddenly it becomes an evening schedule. Well, that person that was going to be able to take care of their child in the morning is not available. So it is so important for us to just understand the forces that are impacting each other.
And I can't help but think that a lot of people care about this, and they want just common decency, which is clearly not so common these days. Karishma, you're not particularly well known, let's face it. Mm. How are you addressing that, down to political brass tacks?
This is going to be one of the challenges. How do I get my name across to 1.4 million people that live in New Hampshire?
Right.
So I am out there daily trying to meet folks. What you're doing, my friend, is a public service by allowing voices like mine that are not bought, that are not controlled by foreign governments, giving us an opportunity to speak, and I hope people will listen. People from across the country can support grassroots candidates, especially ones that are refusing to take any AIPAC money, AIPAC, corporate PAC money, and are not going to be beholden to special interests or foreign governments. If people across the country care for the people of the United States, then they have to vote out almost like a majority of the Congress members.
Yes. And I tell you, you know, America's long been focused on new and improved, and the media focus these days is on new up-and-comers in politics. Mm-hmm. How does that affect your campaign, do you think? I mean, that's what, you know, because a lot of people listening to this show are not in New Hampshire. Most of them are not in New Hampshire, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But they can, you know, if they want to help new up-and-comers, mm-hmm. you know, this is something that's going on.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, may I say...
Oh, yes, you can.
My website link?
Okay. Of course.
So, my website is www.karishmaforsenate.com, and it's, I'll spell it, it's K-A-R-I-S-H-M as Mary A, karishmaforsenate.com. I am very transparent. Again, I'm a scientist. I'm coming from the people. I'm not hiding anything. Many of my main opponent basically... He's running on a platform, it sounds like, that the fact that he's not a Republican. I think that's
barely.
Yes, barely, that's true. And so you'll see the transparency is not there. There's no information about what does this person stand for. If you go to my website, you'll see it's called Our Priorities. I did not write this on my own. We worked on this for 3 months before the launch. A huge group of us. The oldest person that was working on this was in her 80s. And the youngest two were both high school students. And that's the age range of different kinds of people. We were working on it together. So this is a campaign coming from the frustration of the people.
And I can imagine, sorry to interrupt, but there's still more to get to. Young people, I was going to ask about young people. What's their role in this whole effort? I have a lot of faith in young people.
I do too. So they are suffering. So let me see. There were two people in our group that were 25 years old. They were afraid to turn 26. Do you know why?
Right. Yes, I know why. I have a daughter who's in that range. It's insurance.
Insurance. They are on their family's health insurance, and they're going to basically lose health insurance.
Yes.
The interesting thing was they were both working full-time, but nothing, wherever they were, and they had college education, they did whatever they were supposed to do, went to high school, went to college, got a job, but the current system is not allowing them to either save or to have a job which provides health care benefits.
And I think they're getting angry, and they're expressing upset. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So they sometimes ask, where's my American dream? Right. And that is really, it's heartbreaking when you hear this. The other thing that young folks are asking is, of course, livable wages for themselves and for others.
Sure.
They're not being selfish. They're like, we all just, you know, if you work a full-time job, you should be able to afford food, housing, and health care. I mean, this is really a small ask.
So it used to be.
The other thing that they are, what I hear from the young folks is, of course, the war in Gaza.
Yes.
This is very, they want killing to stop. They want suffering to stop. And the third thing that I do hear from them is that, can you please stop burning down the planet that we're about to invade?
Right. And there are a lot of steps that can be taken to not only help the environment, but to help the economy at the same time.
Yeah,
of course, Trump is very mm-hmm. much against that. Now, you may win the Democratic Party nomination, but what about independents and Republicans? In order to be a U.S. senator, you got to win them as well. Do you think your candidacy can appeal to them?
Absolutely, because think about it. If you are providing a policy that is going to benefit the folks, regardless of your political ideology or who you voted for, why wouldn't you care? So when I'm talking about Medicare for All, I talk to everyone about it. I needed to learn about it once. I didn't understand what Medicare for All was, but once I learned about it, I was like, wow, that's a wonderful piece of legislation. Why aren't we passing it? And, you know, this is going back to the start of my nonprofit work, but now I'm passing that baton around. So I'm saying, please, let's learn about this and understand that we are the only developed nation that does not provide a universal healthcare plan and how important it is. So I am talking to everyone and anyone. I don't care who you voted for or what your political affiliation is. You and I are suffering under the same forces, and let's talk, my friend.
And people are looking for a change. They're looking for mm-hmm. something different to address these actual issues. There's mm-hmm. clearly a lack of appeal of so-called centrist mainstream Democrats. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the identity of the party going forward?
Yeah, so I consider myself an FDR Democrat.
Well, me too, oddly enough.
Oh, brilliant, yes. So folks, remember what FDR did, what... Francis Perkins, his Secretary of Labor, did. Don't forget, FDR, you know, not only did he win the Second World War, but also the labor movement was empowered under his presidency. And the impact of that, the pieces of legislation that they passed, the social programs that they passed, ended up building the middle class in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So the 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week, unemployment insurance, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, there was so much going on, and they were all coming from the Democratic Party. The Democrats should remember that we were the party that fought for the working families.
Yes.
But now the leadership of the current Democratic Party, I don't want to call them Republican light, but I'll call them Republican light.
Yeah. Because if the shoe fits, yeah.
the shoe fits, because these neoliberal, centrist, moderates, whatever you want to call them, they just care about their donors. They just care about making, you know, profiting from war or raising money and getting reelected.
Yes.
They are not answering to the people. They are not courageous. They're not bold. And you see this, unfortunately, in a little bit in Chuck Schumer. You see this a little bit in Hakeem Jeffries. I'm going to be kind and say little. So, and you see this also in many of the elected people from here in New Hampshire. Like, you're there year after year after year, and it's just Band-Aids, you know.
Nothing but
Band-Aids, yes. So I hope people will understand that if they are suffering, it is not from lack of resources. We are not a third world nation.
Right.
We are the richest country. People should not have a third world life in our country.
Well, if people are interested in helping out people from all over the currently United States, I say that in jest, how can they help out? What's the website that people can go to again to learn more about you?
Yes, www.karishmaforsenate.com. I would love donations from normal people. There's no other way for me to fight the dark forces, my friends. My opponent is receiving over $811,000 from pro-Israel lobbies, including AIPAC. So we have to fight this. We have to stop the war profiteering, but only if the people rise up. There's no other way for me to fight such dark forces. I need help from across the country. And so, yes, please. So visit my website, and there is a link to donate, and I would appreciate that.
Karishma Manzoor. Again, Karishma sounds like charisma, and there's a lot of power there. Karishma Manzoor, thank you so much for being with us today on Keeping Democracy Alive. This is a heavy lift, folks. Keeping Democracy Alive, it's a group effort for sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care, bro.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial.